Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. This is your co-host, Fanny Crawford.
And Stash Ziolkowski.
Your other co-host.
Right.
Today.
Who always agrees with Fanny.
Oh, yeah. We've just had a fine, exciting conversation for the past hour. Today is Monday, May 6th.
Yes.
Check my numbers.
No, I know it's the 6th because in 2 days, my wife's birthday.
Oh, well, then we're sure of that date.
We're going to have a big, exciting thing on her birthday.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll hear more about that at some point. And our theme today is the beautiful sky, day and night. So we should start out by thanking Andy Offit Irwin for his original composition, Tarry Here, and permission to use it on the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour. Thank you, Andy. You want to talk about Speak in our usual order?
Okay, I will. And I
you have the document.
I have the brochure instead of the 34 pages I copied from the internet. Coming up next Tuesday, May 14th, Carolina, I don't know how to pronounce her name until I meet her, Carolina Quiroga Stultz, and she is a bilingual storyteller, and she's going to be doing a program called Muertos, The Souls of the Dead. That sounds so scary. And then coming up in July, Judith Black, Carolina is coming from Texas. And Judith Black in July, on July 9th, is coming from Massachusetts. And she'll be performing in the Storer Ballroom on King Street in Shepherdstown. Part of Shepherd University. And her program was going to be Bug Girl, which is going to talk about our climate crisis. That sounds a little scary.
Well, only maybe because we've been talking about that.
That's right.
Arguing about that.
just talking about it from different sides.
From different
angles,
standing in different places.
Right, we don't really argue. People who argue wind up being mad at each other and stuff.
No,
we just
that never happens.
Talk about it from different sides. And then coming up in September, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. May? June? I read July's. I'm sorry. This brochure is done in a different way.
It's artistically formatted.
I see. It goes left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right. Instead of
like marching.
Left, 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 left. And yeah, okay. Well, so May 14th is Carolina Quiroga Stultz, Muertos, The Souls of the Dead. And then in June, I wouldn't want to mess this up because Megan Hicks is coming, and she's from Pennsylvania, and she will be in the Storer Ballroom on June 11th. And Megan's going to present a program which will be entitled Boom, Fairy Tales and Stories About Growing Up.
We've heard some of those stories. Right.
And then in July 9th, Judith Black will be here, and she'll be telling stories about the side effects of our climate crisis. And I'm going to stop there because I already messed up enough.
It was a charming error.
Thanks. I'm not sure Adam Booth would consider my announcing charming on his Speak Story series today.
Okay. I'm going to tell a story, or at least the first part of a story. And I think you might have some interesting questions for me at the end of this two-part story. Meeting Thunderbird. The first time I saw Thunderbird, I was a child. And I was looking through a picture book about Native American sand paintings. The photograph that I was looking at showed Thunderbird with his head turned to the side with a crest of feathers on top of his head. He had a hooked beak, almost as long as he was tall. His wings were outstretched. And he had 6 or 7 brightly colored tail feathers. He was mostly black and white, but the feathers on his head and some of his tail feathers were bright blue and deep red. His beak was yellow. And he was holding 3 blue arrows with white tips in each of his 2 red clawed feet. I still have that book, and I look at the photograph often, so it's embedded in my mind. I'll never forget the first time I saw Thunderbird in the sky. It was late afternoon, early evening, I guess. I had just smoked some weed with a friend, and we went outside to watch a Virginia sunset. My friend was pacing about, but I was lying on my back so I could focus on the sky, all those pinks and orange flames, red and purple layers of color, just above a streak of bright yellow light at the horizon, all that remained of the sun. When I looked up higher in the sky at the darkening clouds, there was Thunderbird. His head was a mixture of clouds and sunset. His beak turned to the side. He was looking north, and the cloud crest of feathers on his head mixed with the purple and red-orange of the sunset. His gray and blue wings outstretched in a long trailing tail cluster of feathers, mostly blue, but pink and yellows, too, as they merged with the sun. I stared at him open-mouthed, but I was afraid to talk about him, afraid that I was the only one who could see him. If I said anything, he might disappear. I don't know how long I lay there watching him. It seemed much longer than an ordinary sunset. But eventually the cloud patterns changed and the image of Thunderbird faded away. And I walked with my friend back to the house. I never told anyone about that vision. But for many years afterward, whenever I found myself alone in a car driving down a highway, I'd watch the skies looking for Thunderbird in the clouds. 2 or 3 times I saw Thunderbird-like formations, head turned to the side, wings outstretched. But those were transitory sightings that lasted only a couple minutes, and they never happened at sunset. Makanda. 15 years later, in southern Illinois, I wandered into a tiny village called Makanda, or Makanda, as they said there. It was built up against a railroad line across a couple of steep hills. I'd never seen a town or village laid out that way. There were at least 3 white clapboard churches, each on its own hill, and surrounded by small white clapboard houses that straggled down each slope. On the bottom land ran a long wooden boardwalk, just one street, with maybe 8 different shops or stores. This was the commercial district, but not your typical village shops. The railroad tracks ran along the back of the shops, but the front of the buildings were plate glass display windows with painted signs either right on the glass or above the doors. There was one called the Rock Shop, filled with geodes and coral, semi-precious stones, arrowheads and Native American stone tools, some of them quite old. There was an ice cream emporium, a coffee and tea shop, a building that just said Rummage with a hand-painted sign up above, and then a sky blue doorway marked Arts, Crafts, and Consignments, and my very favorite, the Shop of Three Sisters. That one enthralled me. There was a woman behind the counter about my age with long, long hair. She was wearing an ankle-length cotton skirt, a tie-dyed t-shirt, sandals, and huge silver hoop earrings as she worked behind the counter. I asked if she was one of the three sisters. "Nope, just filling in," she said. There were waist-high cases of silver jewelry, shelves of dried herbs in glass apothecary jars, and hand-dyed handmade clothing. In one corner, there was a 5-gallon jar filled with old and exotic buttons with a sign that said, "Penny a piece." I spent 30 minutes and $3 to bag up some really special old-fashioned fasteners. The woman behind the counter was amused, commenting she'd never seen anyone spend so much time on that jar. "Most people just scoop up a handful," she said. And when I came up to the counter to pay, I saw under the glass top of the counter a box containing a long loop of shell-like material. It turned out to be a necklace made of nearly complete snake vertebrae, a snake skeleton. I asked to see it outside the case. I wanted to hold it. It felt smooth and silky, sinuous, yet a bit mechanical. It fit nicely in my bare hand. But as I started to open the clasp and raise it to my neck, I paused. Did the shop stock this type of jewelry often? No. This was the only necklace of this type the woman had ever seen. How did this snake die? She didn't know. The necklace was in the case when she started working there. Well, how were the bones harvested and preserved? I need to speak to one or all of the three sisters, and they were all out of town this weekend. I stood at the counter with the necklace around my neck. It was strange, to be sure. Scary, but very, very attractive. I hesitated and dithered with myself. It was undeniably beautiful. But I did not want to have it if the snake had died violently or solely for the purpose of someone selling a necklace. I wouldn't be coming back this way again soon, so this was likely my only chance to buy it. It took me a while, but I paid for the necklace and left Makanda. I drove back to the retreat cabin I'd rented for the weekend at the state park a couple miles away. It was now late afternoon, and I wanted to go for a run before dark. I changed into a t-shirt and running shorts, and only then decided I wanted to take the necklace along with me. But it felt disrespectful to sweat on someone else's bones. So instead of putting it around my neck, it went in my shirt pocket. This was my second time running at this park, the same 4-mile east-west loop I'd run the day before. Looking up, I started out on the main park road and watched soft cumulus clouds rolling in from the west. Directly to my left, to the north, was a cloud shaped like a serpent head, facing me, looking at me, with a long body and the tail stretched out in front and ahead toward the east. There was no color to this image, just white and grayish clouds. But it made me smile. I was so pleased to be visited by a great snake. And I tapped the necklace in my pocket to acknowledge the gift of clouds. I turned my head south to my right, and there was Thunderbird, his great head and beak turned to the east, wings outstretched high above me, almost directly opposite Great Snake on my left. That made me laugh out loud. I'd been searching for this iconic figure for more than 15 years, and this white and pale gray cloud apparition was by far the largest and most impressive version I had seen since that glorious sunset in Virginia all those years ago. Even better, the two cloud figures stayed with me for the full 4-mile loop. At times, the head seemed to shift position a bit as if they wanted a better look at me, and the orientation of Thunderbird's wings and Great Snake's tail shifted up or down in the sky, but my running loop was a straight east-west line out and back. As I neared the turnaround point, a long V-wedge of Canada geese approached from the northwest, honking overhead. I counted at least 40 of them and watched till I couldn't hear or see them. They disappeared into the gentle southeastern hills. I turned and headed back the way I'd come toward my little cabin. Thunderbird now on my left and Great Snake on my right. Running hard but steady, I came to the left-hand fork south that would return me to the cabin. The sun was low on the western horizon now, bright pinks and oranges ahead, but bright. I wasn't wearing sunglasses, and it was hard to hold my gaze in that direction. I took the fork, looking back over my shoulder at Great Snake in the northern sky. She was dissipating, her head still visible, but the rest of her becoming amorphous and spreading out to almost nothing. In the south, Thunderbird was larger than he had been, his wings spreading out above as the clouds became thinner and wispier. His magnificent head was merging with the yellows, pinks, and purples on the horizon, but I could still make him out. The sun slipped below the horizon, and I slowed to a walk, turning every few steps to look back, watching Great Snake, now longer and lower in the sky, her tail especially more elongated. Thunderbird's wings were darker, thinner, spread wider. His head was still turned to the side with his beak pointing east, but he was less himself. I stood still then. I stopped to say goodbye, to thank him for this appearance after so many years. I turned back to Great Snake, recognizing that it was probably her serpent wisdom that had brought Thunderbird to me. I was so happy, grateful for these cloud images, and recognizing the time had come to let them go. I thanked Great Snake and raised both my hands to her. Turning back to Thunderbird, I walked on ahead and then bent and picked up a long, perfectly shaped brown and gray speckled wing feather. A hawk, maybe, was lying on the grass by the side of the road. It hadn't been there when I passed the spot at the start of my run. I looked at the feather, feeling its weight in my hand, and the snake bones felt heavy now in my shirt pocket. I pulled the necklace from my pocket with my right hand, and holding the feather in my left, I returned to the cabin and sat on the log steps as the light faded and the first stars appeared. Now or never. It was hard to understand what I'd seen, hard to leave the sky to go indoors, hard to think about what I might do with a feather and snake bones. I skipped dinner that night because eating seemed superfluous. The night was chilly and the wind rising when I finally realized how tired I was and stood up to go into the cabin. I undressed in the dark so I could keep looking at the starry sky above the trees outside the windows. The snake necklace went safely back into its box, into my green duffel bag, zipped up tight. It bothered me that I didn't know where or how those bones left the snake they really belonged to and became a necklace instead. When the bones and I were safely home a few days later, I gave the necklace to an old friend, an elder, a wise woman who had mentored me both in my career and in growing into an elder myself. I told her the story of the necklace of Great Snake and Thunderbird in Illinois, And she asked me why I was willing to give up such a powerful talisman. I had to admit that I was a bit overwhelmed by these bones. I wanted time to absorb the lessons of Snake and Thunderbird. My wise friend smiled, but she took the necklace. Since then, I've borrowed it back from her on two occasions so far. The first time when I turned 60 and was creating a birthday transition ceremony for myself. My mother was still alive then. At some point, I told my mother an abbreviated version of this story, and her response startled me. She stared at me and said in an odd voice, as if seeing me clearly for the first time in, you know, half a century, "Fanny, you're a mystic." Well, yes, that's never been a secret. I majored in the history and philosophy of religion in Chicago in college, but I never called myself that till I heard my mother say it. And even now, I'm not really comfortable with that word. The second time was after my mother died, and I wondered if there was something Great Snake or Thunderbird might have to share with me that could help with my grief and feeling of abandonment. So I went and collected the necklace from my friend. At the time, I was writing out my most important memories of Mom, and that helped the most. But there was also a dream I remember that made a big difference. In the dream, Mom reminded me that she inhabits a different form or state now. Her interests are different than when I last saw her alive. She indicated she was confused about why I would keep calling her back. The dream helped me understand that becoming an elder is partly about letting go of people and patterns I've depended on in the past, exploring new strengths and energies. That snake necklace is still scary to me, but I think I'm ready to explore its power anew.
I love that. That was a wonderful story. I really like that. I had glanced at your papers and your notes before, but I didn't get into it enough to see the connection. I thought it was wonderful.
Okay.
I
want to tighten it up some more. I want to be clearer about why the heck I'm telling that story. And I don't know. It may need to be shorter, but there's so much more I could put in at the same time.
I thought it was wonderful. I think the connection with the sky and the bones, and then a connection again with the sky.
Well, you are my most faithful fan, so.
Well, I found it I found it very enchanting is the word I would
Well,
think
and,
of.
And it did fit the theme.
It did very much.
Because we're talking about beautiful sky, night, and day.
And I learned something. I didn't know that you majored in the history and philosophy of religion.
You've never heard me say that
before. I don't think so.
Wow. Well, obviously I'm not talking to you enough.
Yeah. There were at least two people I know of who would say
disagree.
That's not true. It's very interesting because my oldest daughter, who teaches in a university in Massachusetts, is her major in college was in religious mm-hmm. and women's studies.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's interesting. I can't wait to meet her.
Neither can I. For you to meet her. Okay, that was wonderful. So you are listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, coming to you from Bolivar, West Virginia, at enlightenradio.org. And if you happen to just tune in, you'll be able to hear the first part of the program, certainly by Wednesday, when it will be put up as a blog. And on the internet, you can go to talltales.enlightenradio.org, and there are a couple of years worth of broadcasts there, and you can spend a lot of time listening to Fanny and Stosh on the radio.
And occasionally other storytellers.
And sometimes other storytellers.
We do interview others.
With interviews in that. In fact, I have a note about that to talk to you later off the air.
Okay. I love it when you make notes while we're on air, and I get to hear how your big brain is churning out those ideas.
That was good. Sometimes the truth just leaps right out of your thoughts. Well, at least you didn't say out your pea brain.
No. Never.
Some people. And so, let's see, would you like to mention Stories in the Round?
I would love to mention Stories in the Round and tell our listeners that if I'm not mentioning enough, you're welcome to call me at 301-730-1638 to hear more about our 10-month story series that runs in Hagerstown at the Unitarian Universalist Church, address of which is 13245 Searfoss Pike, just west of Hagerstown, a mile west of the Salem Avenue, Route 58 exit off of 81. Coming up in May 27th, that's Memorial Day weekend, but it's a Monday night, guys. Come on out and hear Elaine Murray telling personal stories, Celtic stories, folk tales from around the world, and accompanied by a stunning movement choreography. Elaine has studied with a series of mimes and movement coaches, and she really does a wonderful job of evoking a whole different side of storytelling. So if you haven't experienced that particular brand of storytelling, if you haven't heard Elaine Murray before, you need to come out on May 27th to hear her at Stories in the Round. June 24th, Noah Baum. July 22nd, Donald Davis. August 19th, Andy Offit Irwin. September 23rd, Jim May. October 18th, Dovey Thomason. Coming all the way from central Pennsylvania. Mitch Capel on November 25th. And December 23rd, Fanny Crawford, closing out the season of Stories in the Round. So if you want more information about any of those performances, or to hear again that it's $10 in advance, $12 at the door, and how to get that advance rate, you can call me at 301-730-1638 or email me at fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com.
That's great information. And that the last storyteller in December must be a relative of yours.
No, she's a complete unknown.
funny.
Do we have any other story events that we need to? Do we have a date for a liars contest at Vendors?
We don't have the date set yet for the liars.
Do we know what month it is?
But July.
July. Okay. So stay tuned.
Stay tuned for that. We had our second Liars Contest just a week and a half ago, and Mark Brew took home the prize.
Woo-hoo!
Which was, he told a wonderful story.
Oh my gosh, it was really, really good.
Very tight. Really well done.
Well,
and all the stories were well done that night.
It was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun.
Plus, we had wonderful food to eat.
That's true. that's true. And let's see. Coming up on May 15th, which will be a wonderful full day with storytelling for me, because I will be, what's the word, wrangling. I love this word. I will be the wrangler for Carolina Quiroga Stoltz in the morning. She performs on Tuesday night, and then on Wednesday she'll be going to two schools. So in the morning I will be taking her to the first school she's going to perform at, and then we'll go to lunch and we'll meet the second wrangler, who will be Carolyn Rodas, and she will be taking Carolina then to the second school that she's going to tell stories that afternoon. And if she's going to do two different programs, I'm going to tag along the second time. If it's the same program, I'm not. Because I have to get ready for that evening. May 15th is our next storytelling guild meeting for the Antietam Storytelling Guild.
At the Flying Camel.
Right. And it begins at 7 o'clock and ends at 9, or when they throw us out, I guess.
And that's at 28 South Potomac Street in Hagerstown in the bottom level. So you have to come in the side alley entrance. But it's a really fun place. And there's wonderful food there, too. Not to mention the fine company.
You could imagine going to a speakeasy in the old days. Into an alley, down a nice, safe walk down the steps in the alley, and then to an entrance.
Yeah.
And it's a very nice place. And they have good food.
They have lots of other activities there.
And lots
there
of entertainment there.
Yeah.
So.
That's enough for now.
Yes.
I think we need a story from Stosh.
Okay. Well. One of my favorite jobs in my 40-year career as a teacher was in a private school in Baltimore, where I was the, during that time, I taught first through sixth grade science, and I also was the director of the planetarium. The Lutkemeyer Cosman Planetarium. It was a wonderful, wonderful place. Actually, the name of that planetarium was the Lutkemeyer Planetarium. It was a wonderful job. I spent an entire summer learning about the equipment in the planetarium. And it gave me a chance to experience something that I have talked about in classes afterwards, when I also taught astronomy at a couple of places. That summer, I would lie on the floor of the planetarium with the star field projected on the ceiling, and I was able to kind of think back and go back mentally to a time when there were no computers, no iPads, no iPhones, no televisions, no movie screens, no paintings on museum walls. There were no kinds of things like that where someone could appreciate art and beauty. And I imagined, as I would have told my, as I have told the students over the years, imagine someone who works all day long, either in the field or maybe in breaking rocks or some activity, has a meal, and finally, late in the evening or even after the evening into the dark of the early night, lies on a hill someplace or in the grass or in even the sand by the seashore and looks up at the sky. And imagine a time when there were no street lights, no lights on a highway because there were no highways, and a person could look up and see all the beautiful stars and planets in the heavens. And over time, many different cultures, many different civilizations, many different peoples saw things in the stars, in the patterns of certain stars, and it made them think they were seeing either animals or people, different kinds of formations in that night sky. And the wonderful thing about this, as the first real important kind of entertainment for human beings, was that the sky was there every night, and those patterns were there every night until the seasons changed. And then there would be a new set of patterns, a new set of stars up in the sky. And many of the ancient people pictured the sky as a giant blanket that covered over all the sunlight and made the sky black, except for there were some holes in the blanket. Those holes always appeared at the same place. But just like a blanket on a bed, you might roll over periodically and move the blanket so that the holes would be in different places. Over many, many years, people saw familiar patterns and began to name them. People saw animals, they saw humans, they saw objects. And in the 1800s, a group of international scientists, astronomers, got together and made it official that there were 88 official constellations. That doesn't mean that you can't see other things, and you can see things that are different than the constellations, and you might even disagree with what the professionals decided on. But just like naming certain things in science, they wanted to make sure that they could have a catalog of the constellations so that people could relate to them, and if they were doing studying of different kind, which has come in handy in the modern era with all our computers and things. I often refer to the reason for this was to keep from so many mistakes. If people wanted to talk about a certain constellation because they thought it always appeared at the same time of the year and reappeared the next time, it was important to have a name that everyone would use. Just as in chemistry, for a number of years, some chemical elements had different names. And it wasn't until the International Association of Applied and International Association of Applied and Structural Sciences, something like that, decided that the names had to be one, that you couldn't have a scientist in Russia calling an element element A and a scientist in India calling it element Z and another scientist in France calling it R. It had to be all the same name, which makes sense. If you're going out looking for gold and it's called something else, you won't find the gold. So with that background stuff, here is a story about some constellations. Ursa Major is one of the oldest known constellations and has more named stars in it than any other constellation. Actually, that may or may not be true. Nowadays, the astronomers label all the stars. They have either a name or else it will have a some kind of letter symbols and then a number. It has been known by many names, but the form of the bear has become the most common, even though it's quite difficult to see this image in the stars. It is interesting that there are many different cultures who see the constellation Ursa Major as a bear, even though, and they've been doing it for a couple thousand years. In Greek mythology, Zeus had many human girlfriends, but his favorite was the beautiful nymph Callisto. His secret visits to Earth to meet with her only added to Hera's jealousy and determination to get revenge against these women. Always find that interesting, that when a wife is wronged by a philandering husband, often the wife will take it out on the women and forgive the man. I think that's not the right way to do it. But that's just me. One day, as Zeus was walking through the forest with Callisto, he saw his wife Hera coming. Unable to hide Callisto in time, he turned her into a large brown bear. When Hera arrived, she saw only Zeus walking by himself through the forest. She looked around, searching for someone with Zeus, but saw only an old brown bear. She still did not trust Zeus, and insisted that he return to Mount Olympus. Zeus did not want to go because he wanted to change his girlfriend, Callisto, back into her human form before leaving. But Hera insisted, so Zeus went with Hera, leaving Callisto as a large, old brown bear. I'm sure Callisto didn't like that idea, especially the old part. Unknown to Zeus, Callisto's son, Arcas, who was a great hunter, was out in the woods hunting. As chance would have it, he saw this great brown bear, put an arrow to his bow, took careful aim, and shot that great bear through the heart. Right before her startled eyes, Arcas watched the bear as it died, changed back into form of his mother Callisto, with an arrow through her heart. Arcas began to cry loudly for his mother and what he had done to her. When he realized it was Zeus that had changed her into the bear, he grew even angrier. Zeus, fearing that Hera might hear the cries, went down to earth to try to appease Arcas. In order to hide what he had done, Zeus changed Callisto back into a bear and placed her form as a constellation into the northern sky. And the constellation of the Great Bear contains what we know as the Big Dipper. He then changed Arcas into the Small Bear, also known as a Dipper, the Little Dipper, and placed him in the sky. As Arcas was being placed into the sky, he turned to look at his mother. That is why the Little Dipper is curved towards the Great Bear, so that Arcas can watch it over his mother Callisto for all eternity. It's amazing to me that this Greek story came from looking up at the sky and watching the constellation of Ursa Major being followed by the constellation Ursa Minor, the Great Bear, and the Little Bear. That's the story of the two bears in the sky.
Yeah, I'd like to think about how that story came about, and maybe they were talking about their neighbors, the people who wrote those stories for the first time.
Yeah, studying the Greek and Roman mythology, just incredible. People often look to the sky to explain things. You know, great storms frighten people, and they looked to some explanation of why the great storm did or did not kill their village, their people, and came up with all kind of stories about heroes in the sky. And the fact that they repeated the difference between, for instance, this story and yours is that in the daytime, clouds appear, and a great thing to do is to watch the cloud formations, and you can see all kind of creatures in it. But they eventually disappear.
Ephemeral.
Right? Sometimes right before your eyes, they change from one to another and then maybe go away. But the night sky doesn't change. Hasn't changed for thousands of years. One of the most difficult things to do if you were to take an astronomy course is to get into your head how those patterns in the sky are still there, even though the scientists, the astronomers tell us all of those stars are moving at incredible speeds and some in different directions. Yet they hold that pattern for a long time.
Well, one of the things I've been thinking about, which relates to your story and my story earlier this afternoon, is whether there are Thunderbird stories among Native American constellation stories. Because, of course, most of the constellation stories that I know are from the Greek and Roman tradition.
Right.
But many, many cultures around the world have their own version of constellation stories. So I've wondered, but I haven't done any research yet about that.
Oh, wait, that's interesting. I wonder if there is a book, a volume that would have Native American.
No doubt.
There must be something like that.
Yeah. So. And then I'll have a whole other set of stories.
Right. It is as a challenge as a teacher to explain to children that the patterns they see in the night sky are not like holes in a blanket or holes in a piece of cardboard or something like
that. Especially when you're showing them a piece of cardboard with holes in it.
Exactly. Because some of the stars in that pattern are millions of miles away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very difficult thing to show.
You need a lot of cardboard.
What you need is, in one school, I used a hallway that was went the entire length of the building.
Oh, and you could turn out the lights?
And I was able to turn out all the lights in the hallway and ask all the teachers to keep the lights out in their classroom for just a few minutes. And I set lamps in different places in the hall, some of them 50 feet away from others, and had my students gather at one end of the building and look down that hallway. And they could see, I used just 5 lamps, and I had one lamp taped to the wall, so it was up in the air higher than another one sitting on a table, and a couple on the floor at different distances, and ask them to copy the pattern that they could see. And they all had the same pattern, because they all saw them in the same mm-hmm. relative position. And then when I turned the lights on and we walked the length of the hall and saw where the lights were, the lamps were, the kids were amazed that they weren't close together.
Oh, okay.
And
so perspective.
Very important. And also, there were some of the lamps I had used a very bright bulb at the end of the hallway.
And to really confuse them.
closer. And to explain to them that, you know, some of the stars are very bright and some are not so bright. And distance can be gauged by how bright the star is. So, anyway, that's not...
Other factors.
It takes other factors, but the brightness of a star and its size helps astronomers to know how far away it is. Anyway.
We could spend all afternoon talking about stars in the sky.
I have another story.
Oh, okay. Well, let me tell our listeners that this is the Enlightened Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. And if you want to hear more and different stories today or any other day, you can go to talltales@enlightenradio.org and hear your fill. Mm. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Just gave me a wonderful idea.
Another wonderful idea.
Yes, I don't know if I could possibly do it, but I live in a town that has a unique set of alleys.
Oh yeah, you could have a star tour.
I could also set up the idea of lights at different distances because the alleys are very, very long.
Mm.
They're many blocks long.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that they're probably at least a third of a mile long. And in that distance, I could set up some flashlights or something at different distances and have...
You could set up whole constellations.
I think I could.
I think you could, too. All right, well, that's another...
And I even know...
Another day, another show.
I happen to know a person who does walking tours at night.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I could use one of the alleys and he could show people it. Anyway, thanks for the idea.
You're very welcome. I don't think it was my idea, but okay.
All right. This is the constellation. This is about Perseus, the hero. The story of Perseus is probably one of the best known of the old Greek myths. This hero was the son of Zeus and Danae. His mother and he were locked in a wooden box by his grandfather, Acrisius, and thrown out into the sea to perish. I have no idea what they did to deserve that. However, the box didn't sink. It floated to the shore of another land. When the lid of the box was opened, golden sunlight filled the box, and Danae, holding the baby Perseus, stepped out of the box. The king of that country, Polydectes, immediately fell madly in love with her and wanted her to marry him. However, she would not marry him, for she wanted to spend her full time taking care of Perseus. When Perseus had grown into a young man, Polydectes tricked him into agreeing to go on a mission for him. The mission was so dangerous that Polydectes was sure that Perseus would be killed. With Perseus out of the way, Danae would be forced to marry him. In order to prove himself, Perseus would have to go to the cave of the Gorgons and kill the Medusa by cutting off her head and bringing it back as proof. The next morning, Perseus went up to the top of a mountain and sang songs to welcome the rising sun. This so pleased the gods that several of them came to Perseus and gave him some gifts to aid him in his fight with the Gorgons. Athena gave him a shield of polished gold to look into so he would not have to look directly at the Gorgons. Hermes, his other name is Mercury, gave him a pair of winged sandals so that would allow him to travel 7 miles at a stride. Hermes also gave Perseus a new moon sword of pale gold, the only one that was sharp enough to cut off Medusa's head. Hades came to give him a helmet that would turn Perseus invisible when he put it on. With these gifts and a special sack to put Medusa's head in, Perseus went to the cave of the Gorgons. When Perseus entered the Gorgons' cave, he placed the helmet of invisibility on his head, and using the polished shield as a mirror, he examined the head of each sleeping Gorgon until he came to the Medusa with her hair of hissing snakes. Being careful to keep looking only into his shield, Perseus slashed downward with his new moon sword, and the Medusa's head was cut off. Quickly, he scooped up the Medusa's head, placed it in the sack, and ran from the cave. On his way home, Perseus was able to use the head to help rescue Andromeda from the sea monster, Cetus. Taking the beautiful Andromeda, who became his wife, he returned home just in time to stop the forced marriage of his mother, Danae, to Polydectes. When Perseus proved his mission a success by showing Polydectes the Medusa's head, Polydectes and his wedding guest all turned to stone. It is said that Perseus gave the Medusa's head to Athena, who attached it to the front of her shield. Perseus lived to a great old age and became the king of Mycenae, which he founded. After his death, Zeus gave Perseus a place among the constellations next to his beloved Andromeda.
Classics.
That's wonderful. My only really big question about that, and when I use that in class with my planetary programs, is a shield made of pure gold, and a sword made of moon gold, which is just dull colored gold, would be extremely heavy. So Perseus must have been in really good shape.
Well, we know that.
Yeah.
Well, I remember that story, hearing that story as a child, and I found Medusa very scary. She was one of the few characters or forces in those myths that disturbed me. And I was not afraid of snakes, so it was something about the juxtaposition of snakes where they did not belong, and that gaping mouth that the drawings always showed.
And you couldn't look at her.
Yes.
Or you'd turn to stone.
And of course, you would want to keep your eyes upon her because she was so scary. So
it makes me think of a story I told on Saturday where if you used the little mirror. And you could look in the mirror and see her behind you, you could keep track of her without looking at her directly. But
we have a podcast, I think, about mirror stories that we've done before.
I think so.
And that story might be on that podcast.
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah. I'm glad that no one asked me about the mirror that I had, because it is a nice, round, thin mirror.
Mm-hmm.
But I put it into a rubber top of a can,
mm-hmm,
or a cardboard circular box, and painted it black. And I searched, tried to find an actual rock that had a smooth back that I could glue the mirror to, but I haven't been successful in that. So that would be really nice to have something like that. But
you mean for storytelling?
Yes. And the other thing is to be able to smash it at the end without cutting my hand or having it fall over.
Well, place. Maybe we should plan another show about mirrors, because I like the idea of outside mirrors. I've been in gardens that had outdoor mirrors where, mm-hmm, you create the illusion of space by placing mirrors around.
Right.
And you can create windows into other dimensions, mm-hmm, even. Right. And they do make mirrors, metal mirrors, for use outside. We used to have a couple that we used with kids in early childhood settings. And, of course, the kids were fascinated by them. And occasionally you would get animals in outdoor spaces,
sure,
who could get really freaked out about mirrors if they weren't.
One of my favorite science experiments to do with kids, and I did it in the library at Sharpsburg. I'm hoping this summer to repeat it in some of the libraries if they have enough space, is to show the anyone who comes to the programs, the library programs, how light transmits images from outer space, and also how we get pictures from outer space that are not really pictures. They're just images that of light. There are images that are converted into light beams. The light beams are then sent back to Earth, and we can change them back into images. And that works really well. Oh, look at this.
It's time to end our broadcast, even though we're having so much fun.
This has been fun. This is Stasia Olkowski and
Fanny Crawford,
your co-host for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, independent community radio in Bolivar, West Virginia. Closing out this week's show, the Epic Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all our stories. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for
Tom Swift.
one of those great heroes.
See you next time.
Are you going to use a magic mirror?
I like that. Do what?
See them.
Oh. I like to say that.
Like Miss Nancy on Romper Room.
Is that what she said?
I'm just, you know.